Welcome to another episode of the From the Scout podcast. I'm Bethany Waring, your host, joined by Alejandro Alonso Lopez and Ida Wood to discuss the second tier racing in America and in Europe, sort of, with the Formula 2 and Indy next. And then we've got some Euro Formula Open, and there might be some other series which may or may not have been happening this weekend. It's been a bit hard to follow. I guess we'll dive in with Formula 2, which has been probably the one everyone was paying most attention with. Ollie Bearman, who managed to do the double, which is not as impossible as I thought it was, and not as never done before, but it's not been done for a while, if I'm correct. So, Will, how does Ollie Bearman's performance stand up to the other doubles, the other domination drives that we've had in Formula 2 and Formula 2's by other names?
I think it's quite impressive, to be fair. I mean, he completed a very, very good weekend, given the circumstances. You know, in the qualifying session, he hit the wall in his second to last attempt, and had his a steering bend for the last attempt. Indeed, he wanted to withdraw from the session, but the team reassured him, as he told the media after qualifying, and indeed, he put that brilliant pole lap that gave him pole, then started ninth due to a penalty toward the driver in the sprint race, and charged back through the field to get the win after some incidents, very bizarre incidents in the coming laps, and again dominated in the feature race. It was impressive, very impressive for a rookie from my point of view in a so difficult circuit. And you know, last year we had the leading driver in the feature race, I think it was Jury Bibbs, crashing out of the lead in the feature race. So the fact that he managed to complete the whole weekend without a substantial mistake that cost him a best result, even though it was close in qualifying, as he has admitted, it's impressive, and it's definitely something to take into consideration for the following rounds.
Yeah, and although we have had double victors in recent years, we had Dragovic at Barcelona last year, and Piastri and Vips and Jeddah and Baku in 2021. 2 years ago, we had the free race format, so you basically had another opportunity to win if you didn't win the first sprint race, which really helped. And before that, yeah, in like the 2010s, the only other occasions were Antonio Giovinazzi, which is also at Baku, and David Valsecchi at Bahrain in 2012. I think Baku helps a lot because really long straights, you know, overtaking opportunities there, not just from, you know, you can come from really far back, get a turn, go past, but also a lot of people go off at turn one, particularly at the start of the race. So if you're starting 10th from the reverse grid, you could easily be sixth or fifth by the end of the first lap. That's kind of element that Baku has. And yeah, Bearman's performance is really good. I've gone through the kind of numbers of everyone who's done the double in the last 50 years. And it's really a list of like 25, 26 drivers in total. And a lot of them are like legendary names. So it's a really impressive achievement. Although the fact that it's been achieved so many times at Baku compared to other tracks maybe suggests that, like, if he'd done this elsewhere, it would have been even more impressive.
Yeah, well, you mentioned now, like, the fact that we have a long straight at Baku. And of course, there is a good opportunity for overtaking there. But as we saw during the races, they shortened the DRS zone by 100 meters, and that definitely made overtaking a bit more difficult. Indeed, the feature race was a pretty calm one. It was all down to strategy for several drivers, and I think that makes as drivers explained after the race as well, all the moves were made under braking, so that makes Bearman's achievement a bit more impressive, even though he benefited from the incidents in the sprint race. I mean, he was spot on when it was about to pass Vesti just before the safety car. He made the most of the opportunity. Vesti went wide. I think it was turn three, and the safety car came out at turn four. So just he was there. He didn't hesitate and pass his teammate, which eventually awarded him the win. And I think that's the most impressive so far.
There were two very different races. I think I woke up early for Formula 2 on the Sunday expecting something mega, and it was just a bit not quite a dull affair, but it was more strategy rather than the total chaos we saw during the sprint race. We had it was a case of safety cars, I think, and then that weird end with a pile-up sort of thing with one driver on top of the other because one of them didn't have anywhere to go. And what do we have from that? What did drivers make of that incident? It looked like a couple of drivers making a mistake and then a lot of other drivers not having anywhere to go. So what?
The overall conclusion, I think it was that tires wearing after temperature. I mean, it was really difficult to keep the brakes alive and also the tires during safety car periods. So as soon as there was a safety car period that was even indeed quite long, you know, the lap in Baku is quite long. So as soon as you have three laps behind the safety car, it's 18 kilometers that you are going at reduced speed and you are losing lots of temperature. So yeah, they go all there wanting to not break too early in order to avoid losing positions. And what's been shown also in the past, that's what I was kind of surprised to see, so many drivers going off and ending up there in the barrier at turn one in the sprint race. Because, you know, we've seen that in the past, and with the fact that this year seemed a bit more difficult to overtake, I expected drivers to avoid such mistake. But anyway, it wasn't like that. Drivers again went wide, and some ended their race in the barrier, which is a shame for some. I mean, Hauger, who was on the lead, lost it all. And I don't know, it's difficult to understand how a driver who's leading the race, also second placed Martins, to lose the race like that. I mean, I don't want to be so hard on them, but it is, I think they should be a bit more careful on that, because at the end of the day, they are losing points that might be very, very valuable to the championship in the end.
Another thing with like the cold tires is the tires can get warm around the lap, but because of how long the straight is, it's not just the fact that they get cold, but they get cold then hot, then cold then hot, and that impacts how much rubber is essentially ripped off the surface of the tire and left on the track, and then how much the tire would usually pick up back from the track once it's really hot and sticky. But in this instance, it almost becomes less grippy by the time you get to the end of the straight. So turn one, you almost have no grip, but in sector two, you have basically better grip. And obviously that's where you've got more downforce coming into play anyway with those corners. So although it's actually like tighter margins in terms of walls there, turn one's the hardest corner on the track, purely because of this weird tire phenomenon. And they also, I think, resurfaced quite a lot of the track last year. So that's asphalt that's smoother and hasn't had as much day-to-day tire rubber put on as well. And obviously car tires, because of street circuit, will be of different composition to a Formula One tire. So any other kind of rubber a hot tire is picking up from the surface may not necessarily be a sticky Pirelli tire. It may be, you know, something of very different condition, and therefore it will give you a different level of traction around the lap. So it's one of the hardest tracks to really do it, particularly at this time of year. It tends to help when the race is in like June, but because it was held at the end of April, that made it a lot harder as well.
A race to forget for Ayuma Iwasa, who was a former championship leader now down in P3. Is that just another victim of Baku? Although he retired from race one and then finished outside the points in race two. I think it was a qualifying, just difficult qualifying, difficult week.
No, you are right. It was indeed a weekend to forget for the whole dance team. I mean, there is little to say. Just Arthur Leclerc, who benefited from the Victor Martin's disqualification in the feature race, picked up a point for dance during the weekend. But they were so far off the pace, both in quali and race. So there was not much to do for them. They kind of recovered a bit in the feature race thanks to the strategy. They were able to advance a bit, but it wasn't enough. And yeah, they'll need to work and up their game for the coming runs. Hopefully we'll see them up there again and fighting for wins like they were in Australia, because they've shown great pace in previous runs, and now they were nowhere in Baku, definitely.
And Awasa at the end of the weekend also kind of pointed out a few errors from the team as well. I think they mistimed sending him out for like his main run in qualifying, which then kind of restricted, if you get it wrong the first time, do you have time for a second lap as well? I think they had some kind of issue with the tyres they'd selected. Obviously, you get a select compound, but as in, of the tyres you got in the garage, I think they might have chosen one that wasn't in the best condition. Well, not quite sure, but he said he was really frustrated afterwards about the fact that they'd picked this tyre, and obviously then had a retirement in that session as well. And then he got a 5-second penalty for overshooting virtual safety car timing, which, you know, with experience, you should be used to. At a track like Baku, it's the kind of thing you'd expect. So you should also be ready for that kind of radio message, or you see the flag saying VSC. So it almost sounds like, not quite immaturity, but because other things went wrong around him, he then started making errors himself, and then it kind of grew and grew as a problem and ended up being his worst round in like a year.
Yeah, indeed. If I'm not wrong, if he had not made that mistake behind with the bigger virtual safety car, he'll have picked up the last point. But anyway, I mean, it is what it is, and he must improve. He and the team must improve and learn from that for the future.
Well, he's got a bit of a break now to learn. We're back racing on 20th of May with in Imola, and then I think it's back-to-back-to-back with Monaco, and then Barcelona coming up immediately after. So it's going to be a busy few weeks for the Formula 2 guys after a month of nothing, and then another half a month of nothing. So I guess there's a lot of time to go over the data, look at what went wrong, what could be better, and on tracks that these guys should know. Some of them will have been racing at Imola since they were like 15 in Formula 4, so we should have some good racing coming up. Switch over to Indy next, which I was actually on duty for that, because I've taken that on. Christian Rasmussen takes the championship lead after winning in a race. It was similar in a way to the Formula 2 races, in that one race was very chaotic and then another race was very chill, but those races took place in the same race, essentially. If you were anybody other than Christian Rasmussen, it was chaos of Formula 2 race 1. If you were Christian Rasmussen, there was not much happening. You just had your race impacted by safety cars a couple of times, and then a weird red flag in which Louis Foster ended up in the gravel, and then they didn't seem to be able to get his car out of the gravel, which was a bit of a strange one. There was another safety car incident for Matteo Nannini and Jacob Abel, who came together. It was another bad weekend for the championship, for the former championship lead now, with Daniel Frost and Josh Green coming together on the final lap, so that Daniel Frost now drops down the order to P3, and Christian Rasmussen takes the championship lead. Either do you have anything to add to that chaotic summary, or you will still be my reports?
Yeah, and I was listening to the race on IndyCar radio in the background while I was in the Algarve Media Centre, and it sounds like from what you had said from watching the race that they tried to hide, like, on the TV broadcast because it was so embarrassing, the fact that the reason the race got red flagged was a recovery vehicle had got stuck in the mud. And the IndyCar radio guys are chatting about it, but clearly the TV crew's like, we're not going to show that. That's too embarrassing for us. Yeah, generally like a messy race for drivers who, you know, have proven themselves not only to be fast, but to be competent racers. And so many of them are making major mistakes. And it's not like an F2 where you're suddenly on a new tyre compound halfway through the race. In Indy Lights, you should be able to get the tyres up after two or three laps and you should be good thereon. And they don't like drop off massively like Pirelli tyres do. They do have a drop off point, and they tend to have it almost a few laps from the end of the race to kind of cause that drama and stuff. But then drivers anticipate it and they start saving before then. So, yeah, again, another weekend where, like, it would have been better to have two races. But because, like, with the way Penske are running this championship now, and yes, they've increased the car count, but we're getting less racing. We're getting races that have so many safety car, like, caution periods and... and in this instance, a red flag, and some of the drivers as well crashing out on, and I think we had this in St. Petersburg as well, crashing out really early on, and then being let back into the race later on, like once cars repaired, which seems a bit odd, but I guess it's almost like a PR thing. You want to see Jamie Chadwick on track, you want to see Jagger Jones, you want to have as many cars on track as possible because it looks better. But you know, I think it'd be run very, very differently if it was like a European-based series. So I'm just continually not impressed by how Indy Next run. And there's another series we might talk about later, which is being run very badly.
Yeah, it was what, it's a weird one. I followed Indy Lights as it was for a few years, but this, I don't know if it's maybe just this year I'm focusing on it more, but it just seems to be a bit more messy. There was one point during the red flag, because Matteo Nannini and Jacob Abel had already crashed out at this point, and during the red flag, I think it was Nannini was getting back in the car or looking to get back in the car, and it's like, this is just so weird. There's the whole safety cars breed safety cars thing, but then if you're going to let those cars back on track, sometimes things happen and it's not your fault, and it's not fair that you don't get to finish your race and everything, but sometimes that's just how racing is, and you just got to sit this one out. And then on the other hand, if you're on track, you're at least learning and maybe getting better. It was just so much chaos. And I think I just want to, it's weird to say this after the second race of the weekend, of the season, but I think new qualifying format, or at least a qualifying format we hadn't picked up on, and it's essentially there's 20 minutes for qualifying, but it's 8 minutes green flag running or 20 minutes, whichever comes first. So basically, if you have 8 minutes green flag running, then that's it. It means that qualifying is very chaotic in the first couple minutes because everyone needs to get out there as soon as possible. If you're not on track straight away, you're gonna miss your opportunity to qualifying. But it also means that these guys aren't getting as much on track experience as they might need. We've talked about it in FIA series about should Formula 2 and Formula 3 get more attention rather than F1 practices. But it seems to also be something we should maybe be discussing in the Indy ladder, because they're not getting much track time, and with just one race and then 8 minutes of qualifying, it doesn't seem like the most fun championship to be in.
Yeah, and with the actual scheduling of an IndyCar event, where you have, obviously we've always had like Indy Pro and USF 2000 there, but we now have USF Juniors as well. But they deliberately schedule all of those sessions to be on like Thursday and Friday. So the USF Juniors guys are already out of the paddock by the time Indy Next was on track. So there shouldn't be any impacts on like the ability to have full length Indy Next sessions with the addition of that lower rung series joining the support bill. So that's a bit disappointing. 8-minute qualifying is, I think it's entertaining, but like, particularly like, oh, as much as qualifying is about just going out and going as fast as you can, you go out, you then go back in, feed it to your engineers and go, the track condition is currently this, because obviously practice would have been 4 or 5 hours before, or maybe longer, so it's going to be gripped up. So we need to do this tweak to the front wing. We need to maybe change tire pressure or whatever. And then you go out and do your second run and you put in the lap that you want for pole. In 8 minutes, you've got like a 2-minute outlap, which leaves you basically 3 or 4 flying laps total. The first one's going to be like feeling yourself around the track, checking out if you really can push limits. And then you've got 2 or 3 where obviously you're going to have other cars around you. So, you know, I mean, it's good for the drivers in like, it really prepares you for IndyCar, but also it doesn't actually prepare you for what IndyCar teams want, which is drivers who can go out, tell what the track feels like, tell what the car feels like, go back to the engineers, tell them exactly what changes they need, and then go out and put it on pole, etc. Another thing with cars like rejoining the race or being classified, etc., is in Indy Next, even if you retire and it's like a 20 car grid and hypothetically and you the first to retire, you score points to 20th place. It doesn't matter how many laps you do, you still score points for each position. So you could have a race with 4 finishers and someone would still get the points of 5th, which, you know, makes it even weirder as a series and should disincentivize actually teams wanting to go back out on track, because they've already got a guaranteed point score regardless of how long their race lasts if they don't meet the checkered flag.
It's a very strange series. Indy Next isn't the only championship to do this. We're giving you a time slot, but you only get to fill 8 minutes of it. I won't go into it, but there is a certain sports car championship for 14-year-olds that does something similar. It's a weird one, especially with how much drivers will be paying for this, and then trying to get their sponsor's name out there. Do you really want to sponsor a car that's going to be on track for like an hour, even if you finish every lap of the race? It's maybe not the most economically great sponsorship opportunity. So we'll go on. We'll go to Do you want to bring up now your mention, Alejandro, so that you don't have to bring this up at the end? But you wanted to give a shout out to a driver who impressed you.
Yes, of course. Thank you, Bethany, for reminding it. I mean, I didn't want to move on, especially from Formula 2, without giving a shout out to Kush Maini and also Isaac Hatcher, who came back from 14th and I think 18th in the grid respectively and ended the feature race in 5th and 7th. I think they completed a great feature race, to be honest, and they benefited from the strategy. They kept calm and progressed in the coming stages of the race. They weren't greedy and in pushing the tires too much in the beginning, overheating them, which was one of the issues this weekend, not tire deck, but thermal degradation and overheating, and they did a fantastic job. So well done to them.
So we're moving swiftly on to your Formula Open, which was in action in Portugal. Not the greatest grid size, but it was. And strangely, after one round of a championship, the person leading the championship hasn't actually won a race yet. So I think you were on the ground there. Do you want to talk us through that weekend? What's the state of play in your formula?
The state of play is not good. So we've got like 7 confirmed full season entries. We had 10 cars on track at the weekend. 2 of them were 3 of them were for one round only. Paolo Brajnik at MV Racing was kind of planning to do more races based on how well Algarve went, and Algarve went terribly, so he probably won't be back. Then Tim Tramnitz won't have the budget to do any more, even though they've got like some ADAC support there. Trulli, his priority is Japan, and spoke to Motor Park, and they were like, we'd love him to do more rounds, but really, like, it might be one and that's it. So yeah, and Trulli and Chamlitz were the top two drivers most of the time during last weekend, so it was a bit embarrassing kind of seeing them fight out really closely at the front and then everyone else being a fair bit behind. Motor Park, who are usually super dominant, also had some pretty embarrassing problems as well. They had a mechanic who kept accidentally plugging in the batteries wrong on cars, which led to Jakob Bergmeister not starting one race and one car stalling at the start of another, or just not getting away, and then had to be wheeled into the pits and then got going because they had to pretty much jump start it as if it was like a road car. So that was crazy embarrassing. Noel Leon had a clutch issue but then drove really well after being like 30 seconds off the pace to come back to fifth place. And then in race three of the weekend, he won after Trulli and Chamlitz for like the third time that weekend made contact, and Chamlitz went off. Trulli was already spinning. Leon just went past both to win. And considering Leon, I don't think he even scored in Formula Regional Europe last year, that kind of shows the level of the grid this season, which is not great. Motor Park is a step above the other teams. They basically had six cars out, although they kind of split between Motor Park and Crypto Tower. Francesco Simonazzi and BVM Racing can be strong, but then Simonazzi sometimes lacks confidence, or the opposite problem is he's overconfident and then he causes crashes, which isn't fun. Juju Noda, off the pace, you know, she'd be 20 seconds ahead of a driver and within 10 laps would be behind, so that wasn't fun to watch over. Vladimir Neta still, I think he had an engine problem that ruled him out one race, or a gearbox issue, so he missed, I think, qualifying in race one, so that wasn't fun either. So yeah, aside from Trulli and Chamlitz, you know, racing really closely, it was a pretty mundane weekend, and trying to figure out which teams might actually have more cars later in the year. And basically, all the teams that weren't there have sold their cars on to like club racers who aren't going to do Euro Formula. BVM does have a second car, but also they're basically supporting Brashnik kind of last weekend in an almost unofficial relationship. So if Brashnik continues, he'd likely utilize some of the BVM engineering knowledge potentially. So that would mean we have like an eighth, at least part-time entry. But yeah, otherwise it's just a sad series to watch. One of the people within the organization that runs it told me during the weekend that they'd actually considered or contemplated pre-season that if they have less than 10 cars and they don't think the grid's ever going to go beyond 10, they would just not run the series. Wouldn't be worth it. But we were here this weekend. Well, we were here last weekend with 10 cars. So maybe if there'd only been 9, maybe we wouldn't have seen any racing. That's potentially what could have happened there. Po Grand Prix wasn't supposed to happen with Euro Formula. They were supposed to have electric cars plus Formula Regional Europe, but then Formula Regional Europe didn't want to go. The electric car thing collapsed with World Sporting Group. So then they basically called up TCR Europe and Euro Formula and said, do you want to race here? We need to run the Grand Prix. So that's why Euro Formula's in France next week. So yeah, not looking good. And then the kind of personal dislike of what's happening right now is on Facebook, they've posted 13 times in the last 5 months and the Twitter hasn't been active since last October. Like, it's so obvious why nobody's competing, because it's not being promoted, it's not being you know, that there's no links to the YouTube streams of the races. They do broadcast most sessions and all the races, but you wouldn't know that unless you were subscribed and had notifications on for the channel. So it's just very badly run. And yeah, let's just say I was there until quarter to 11 on Saturday night, and a lot of the PR team and people from the series left at around 7 p.m., which I think says a lot about, you know, how that series is being run. Hopefully things will change. I doubt they will. The maximum number of cars really you can get this year is 12 or 13, because there are literally no other Dallara 320s owned by teams that can run drivers. All those cars now are in the hands of wealthy Italians, essentially, who only want to do club racing. So, Yeah, and also my Chromebook broke during the weekend because I got chased across the Portuguese countryside by a pack of wild dogs on the way to the circuit on Friday morning. So, yeah, that was a disappointing way to start the first round of the season.
I'm curious to know how much of this is actually going to make it into the podcast. So, Tim Tramnitz has been very busy these past couple of weeks. I'm surprised if budget is an issue for him, why bother to do the Euro formula? Not that I don't want to disrespect the series that seems so awesome after your comments, but I feel like I'd rather save that and go do a test in Fracker or something. Save that money. So why bother doing it? And it's not a track that Fracker go to, so it's not why.
A, he had a free weekend. B, it was incredibly last minute. When Motorpark put it on their Instagram, as far as I'm aware, the deal had not actually been signed by that point. So they kind of announced him before it was all confirmed and entered with GT Sport, who ran the series. So he wasn't officially on the grid at that point. And also, based off the points he scored last weekend, although Euro Formula Super License quota will be smaller this year because of how few cars are on the grid, he could still potentially come like sixth or seventh in the standings. So he'd still get potentially like a few Super License points, which might equate to the exact same number he would get by doing the full FRET campaign with big grids, and where he is looking competitive, but to finish, fifth in the standings there is going to be considerably harder than turning up to one or maybe two Euro Formula rounds, racking up easy points because there's barely any cars, and then taking a reduced but still handsome amount of Super License points off the back of it. So it's kind of good use of money. And also, I think in like Trulli's case, he's obviously taken his career to Japan now. Tramnitz, although he's got the ADAC backing, he's done the Formula E rookie test, I think. And if you feel good in this car, there are teams in Japan that, I mean, Formula Regional Japan and Super Formula Lights are really trying to push to get international entries again. So, if he feels I like this car, I'm fast in it, he might next year decide to either do the whole of the Euro Formula season or hold a Super Formula Lights. And also by having that experience now, it then means he can sign with the top teams potentially. Later this year for 2024, rather than leaving it last minute, which is obviously what happened with his outing and also with Formula Regional. But
It's a method to the madness then. So, moving on to a better organised potentially series, we had F1 Academy had its first weekend race of the season. You might have missed it. I think I managed to miss it. I don't know how I managed to do that. It wasn't a sarcasm aside. I don't know if you picked up on that. It wasn't maybe the best from actually. I think it was pretty well promoted. Not the best broadcast, watchable, followable series we've of all time. Which is weird. I feel like we've had these same comments about W Series in the past. So I didn't follow it. I'll own up to that. I think either you followed it best from Portugal, and then I think Alejandro, you kind of followed up with the driver. So do you guys want to explain what happened to anybody who may have somehow managed to miss it?
Yeah, well, I had the pleasure of attending the very first press conference with Familia roundtable of the series, and to ask the very first ever question. That was Formula Scout there. We were there in the Bitumi press conference. It was a pleasure, but honestly, as you mentioned, there was no live broadcasting of the races, and also with same issue with the qualifying, which made the following a bit difficult. It was a big disappointment, I think, from all of us in the media, but also for the fans who were expecting to watch the new series after all the promotion it had. So yeah, it was a shame on that side, but apart from that, they managed to run the three races in one weekend. I was surprised that somehow they did that without big issues with cars and stuff. And then, of course, with the disqualification of Abbey pulling in from qualifying, it was the road got easier, got clean ahead of Marta Garcia and it's her Prema, who won race one and race three. And according to her words, he could have done a bit more in race two, but he didn't want to risk too much considering he had to do race three a couple of hours later. So, yeah, that's pretty much all from my side. I think Aida will be able to give us some more insight on what happened at Spielberg.
Yeah, I think the pulling disqualification and like the Roding Carlin cars is one of the interesting points. I'll admit I haven't read the technical regulations, but you know, we've had Formula 4 series for like 9 years now. This car has been around for 2 years. And regulations are normally pretty clear on what parts you can and can't have because they are supplied by the company you buy the car from. So to have non-homologated parts in the first round of this new series is like, A, where did you get them from? B, how did you get them outside of the spec that like the regulations are written to? And how did you not realize they're out of regulation like before you then put them on the car? It does seem really odd that we've had such a major technical breach committed over several cars, because sometimes things like plank wear can occur because of the car going on track, but this is a blatant something, you know, the car itself before it goes on track is illegal. So that's like just very unusual to see. And we had some other penalties in disqualification again later in the weekend. We did have live timing, which we had live timing a bit during testing. Then we had no live timing because they blocked it. And then I made a very public complaint about it. And almost immediately afterwards, live timing came back on. I was like, that's a bit sus. And a lot of other journalists were like, as we're all list like tuning into live timing at the same time, trying to get to it. Then it went off again and it came on and it was on for all of the races, but it wasn't on for like the other series that are on that weekend, even though F1 Academy was supporting, I think like the SP9 challenge or something. So, but they had their own separate live timing thing. And it looked like they were blocking earlier in the weekend some of the GPSs. You couldn't track them around the circuit, which is always a bit concerning. W Series used to do that as well. But when it came to the actual races, we could actually follow them. Now, to get like an audio commentary should have been easy. You could quite literally just get someone to sit in a commentary box and watch the race and you broadcast it to a website or to Facebook or whatever without having any footage rights. Because the F1 Academy is supporting like 5 or 6 different series this year, they've then got to negotiate with the rights holders for all those series and those circuits to go out. Like, do you have your own camera crews already? Who are you broadcasting to? What's your broadcast team? What's the price they charge, etc.? And they've then got to do that for every single round. Normally you do that before the season, you do it once and that's job done. So they kind of dug themselves a hole by supporting so many different championships, all of very different levels and like media capacity. Some of them are heavily involved in like live streaming, involving media, things like that. Others are more, not quite club racing, but people are racing for passion and not for careers. So there is less of an onus on having that kind of live broadcast element. So definitely an avoidable issue that they left until last minute. And even when admit they'd left it last minute, we had other outlets calling them out as well. And, you know, although it may have looked unprofessional for the media to be doing that, to be calling them out, it was because F1 Academy looked so unprofessional being so behind closed doors and everything. So that was really like, hopefully they learn a lesson from that in time for the next one. And they're doing the VMRs, but problem with a media roundtable when you're supposed to be asking questions about the race, well, if you can't watch the race, how do you ask questions about it? You might as well just ask the driver what happened. But if they were leading the race, they're not going to know what was, you know, going on to the cars behind them. So it's the fact that because it's like an F1 own series, FOM, etc., they ultimately have the rights to a lot of trackside footage, photos, that kind of stuff. So any media who are going to the next round are being briefed as if it was an F1 event, saying like, you can't video the cars while they're on track, or video, you know, the paddock, because that is technically...
You can go in the pit lane during a live race though, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, you definitely can. In, the thing is, with in Britain, it's far stricter than Europe. Like, all I have to do is turn up and pay €20 for a bib in Algarve, and then I'm allowed in the pit lane the whole time while it's live and on the pit wall, leaning over it. But in Britain, I have to have £5 million insurance to be allowed media access to any like trackside photography places or the pit lane. So F1 Academy should actually benefit from the kind of laxer rules that are in place in Europe, that you don't require insurance and stuff. So you'd then, you know, if I were them, you'd want like influencers coming to events. You want people who are using their online presence to essentially broadcast F1 Academy, not in, you know, hour long segments, but in 10 second clips and photos and videos. But they've already briefed the media saying this is as if it was an F1 event. You can't do those things because FOMs ultimately owns the rights to it. So it's, yeah, it's for a junior series where it's all about like these drivers preparing for the next levels. It's so unlike the next levels and experience them. They're being closed off from the media. They're being closed off from data, you know, from the rest of the world. It's an isolated kind of chamber, which is never a good space for any kind of sport to run in. Even during the pandemic, we had more access to live sport than we do of F1 Academy, which is, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah, I feel like we've criticised W Series a lot on this podcast, but at least in the first year, it was really hyped that, like, there was so much access, there was so much filming. You really got to know who these drivers were and what they were doing and what their goals for life were and everything. And I went to the, when they were at Brands Hatch, and there was so much access in the paddock and trying a sort of festival vibe to it and getting young fans to go up and meet the drivers. And so even there was some there was still argument, reasons to criticize W Series, and maybe they were treating it was more kind of like a reality TV show than a race series at times, but at least it was something you could watch, which F1 Academy seems to have gone the completely other way, in that it's a race series, but you're not allowed to watch it, and it's difficult, and which is a shame for these drivers, and the whole thing behind them is supposed to be raising their profile and everything. And how do you raise your profile and how do you get sponsors and stuff to say, like, look, I'm racing in this series, you can't watch it, but I promise I'm doing well. I promise it's great, and I'll shout out your company if I ever get to speak to anyone.
And like another thing is W Series straight away committed to supporting DTM, and DTM at any event is like a big festival, like huge festival vibes. And therefore, like, W Series wanted to implement their style, their control, but ultimately DTM was overseeing what they were doing when they were using that paddock space. So that kind of helped them, even though that wasn't what they wanted. But ultimately, DTM created that publicity by default. And I remember they actually used to get very annoyed that, because I already knew the drivers, I already knew High Tech, who are running the cars in the inaugural season, I would talk to them directly, and they're like, no, you need permission from us to talk to anyone. I'm like, well, I'm a journalist who's known these drivers for years, so I don't care. And then they then supported F1 at races, and therefore were able to bring the series to more territories, etc. And that's the same pipeline for F1 Academy. They're going to support F1 next year and the year after if this series does exist. But and in capacity, that means things will go behind a paywall, to particularly broadcast, even for live timing, potentially. You might have to pay for that. It will be accessible, but it will be only if you can afford it, which is another argument. But then that also still brings it closer to F1. You need F1.com, whatever, access to get F1 timing. So it's like, a similar thing there. So ultimately, in a season where they're not supporting F1, they should be maximizing the fact that they're not, but they're kind of doing the opposite. And other series with far smaller profiles or presences, like Chinese F4 is easier to work with. And I have to work with people in a language I don't speak, and in a country where they're, you know, they're very limited in what they can actually share abroad. So that kind of shows the extent of F1 Academy's direction at the moment.
Well, what else was on this weekend? What else?
USF Juniors. That was because, as we kind of mentioned earlier, it was on like Thursday and Friday on the IndyCar weekend. So I was at work. I can follow it. Obviously, I then like watched everything back because they put it on YouTube, but it was pretty kind of mundane weekend for those guys. And you can already see a clear title picture emerging there. So I think it might be a bit of a boring season. Danish F4, all of their races are broadcast live. Qualifying was broadcast live on YouTube. And I think with audio commentary, and you get live timing on the Danish websites. And they do interviews with all the drivers literally as soon as they get out of the car. Paddock's really accessible, et cetera, et cetera. We also had the first round of ACCR F4, although technically the second year of it, but now with the kind of Czech formula tag and second generation cars. And that also didn't have broadcasting. And also the first round of that has been postponed initially from last year to this year. Then they were supposed to, I think, do a round at the start of last month. That got cancelled. So they've had like logistical and other kind of challenges to get around, and a broadcast would be low in their priorities. They just wanted to get the series off the ground, and they have done that with six cars. So, you know, there's a bigger focus on broadcasting there. And ultimately, if you're driving in that series, your sponsors aren't seeking coverage around the world. They just want, you know, like a photographer there who can see the logos on the side of the car, and then you sell it to like Czech or Hungarian newspaper ads, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it'll be more exciting to see if that, not only if they have more cars for the next round, but because they're going to be, I think, with a more major championship, if they then go in on the PR stuff as well, and we get like an Italian F4 style PR approach to that championship.
Speaking of Italian F4 coming up this weekend, we have pretty much every Formula 4 championship in Europe, I think. We've got British Formula 4 at Brands Hatch, Italian in Misano, Spanish at Spa-Francorchamps, which isn't in Spain, and French F4 in Magny-Cours, and of course GB4 and GB3. And F1 Academy may be on, hopefully. We'll see how much coverage we get of that this weekend. And Euro Cup 3 also at Spa-Francorchamps. So it's going to be a weekend where we don't get to sleep or have tea breaks this weekend. I think I'm covering about 3-4 different series and then filling in some gaps. I'd all be on 10 different series. So anything else on the website we should be looking out for this weekend, this week?
I think Euro Cup 3 launching will be the biggest kind of story. They've got one, I guess, high profile signing that'll be announced later this week. It's kind of already been announced. Everyone knows who it is, who's been following Euro Cup 3 and the teams taking part. But I think they're going to be announced on Thursday once they're actually at the track. And I wouldn't be surprised if they win it by some margin. We've got Alex Palau's own team, Palau Motorsport, which is quite cool to see. It's run by his dad for obvious reasons. But still, like, they've attracted big names. I'm interested to see, once the teams are on track actually racing, if they enjoy doing, like, if it's really close racing, I think it'll be fine. But if we have a team establishing itself as the one to beat again, I think that's going to be frustrating for a lot of them, because part of the reason Euro Cup 3 was created was because Motorpark was dominating Euro Formula, and they kind of set it up as like a rival series based on Formula Regional cars, but with some modified aero, and I think a little lighter as well. So yeah, they're kind of hoping not to make the mistakes that were made in Euroformula and running of the championship, and also in the competition level, because if one team dominates, then interest is going to wane very, very quickly, particularly for drivers as well, because Formula Regional Europe has such high profile races at a lot of similar tracks. The teams competing in that series also compete at FIA 3 and F2 level, whereas Euro Cup 3's team list is generally occupied by kind of Spanish F4 teams. So it'll be interesting to see not only kind of how the first weekend goes, but then the paddock reaction from that to the next round, if anything changes either in the sporting regs or like in how they promote the series, because like F1 Academy and like ACCR F4, it's the very, very first weekend.
Alex Clough, that's McLaren F1 Junior, right? Or is that another IndyCar star?
He's technically an F1 Junior now, which is weird to say. 2021 IndyCar champion, and then McLaren like revamped their driver development program a week ago now, and randomly announced that Pato O'Ward and Palou were effectively juniors, even though like they're already professional racing drivers, highly established for years. And yes, they do hold like F1 test and reserve roles, but they're certainly not juniors. But because of the way I think they wanted to promote the program, the big announcement, they're like, yeah, we'll just announce them as juniors. Job done.
Not to mention the fact if you're trying to argue, yeah, IndyCar deserves more super license points. IndyCar's great and everything, but also the champion is our junior. It's not a great look, but I don't think there's going to be much to convince F1 about IndyCar. Anyway, so that was this very positive Formula Scout podcast. We will have another Formula Scout podcast soon, hopefully talking about some series we really enjoyed covering. Formula 2 was great in comparison to everything else, it seems. And honestly, I enjoyed covering Indy next, even if there wasn't an amazing amount of track time. But we'll make up for that this weekend with a ton of Formula 4 series. Anyway, so see you next time for another Formula Scout podcast.